So welcome everyone to the June session of, this is the season finale of the 17th season of the Kolos Torah for Tycoons program. Thank you as always to the Harry H. Baron Trust and to Rabbi Zev Baron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons as we complete 17 years, which is nothing to sneeze at. That's a pretty good run with Hashem's help of 17 years of doing this program. The new season will begin in Mir Tashem, God willing, in September, and hopefully Hashem continues to help the world emerge from the COVID pandemic. We are hoping to be back in person at the Yisrael Kosher Deli come September, and hopefully, God willing, that will happen in September. At the moment, we're still on Zoom. I want to encourage all of you, as always, to consider having a conversation with one of the Kol rabbis about the Kolel's Live On Life and Legacy program, which is organized here in Denver by Rose Community Foundation. It's helping the Kolel, many other Denver organizations, create future financial stability through plan giving, like wills, estate planning, and endowments. Okay, so I'm just bringing myself into the camera here a little bit better. Okay, and without further ado, I would like to present our presenters, and to introduce our presenters, and Rabbi Hillel Goldberg, who is the editor and publisher of the Intermountain Jewish News. In addition, Rabbi Goldberg is uniquely suited for this conversation as well because he is also has extensive experience in the area of, has written extensively on the area of the Mussar movement. He has written a recently republished work put out, I believe, by Art School Masorah. And in fact, I checked it on their website. It's there. You can buy it if you'd like, called The Fire Within on the Mussar movement. And I believe also an extensive work on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Mussar movement. So when you're talking about the world of journalism and ethics coming together, we have an individual here who is uniquely positioned to be able to talk about both of those subjects as they meet, collide, clash. We'll find out. And the other presenter is myself, Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, as the senior educator. So Rabbi Goldberg, I hand the floor over to you.
I want to thank you, Rabbi Fleischer, not only for this invitation, but for all the good work you do throughout the community and for your scholarship and for your dedication and for the Kolel that you represent so well.
Thank you.
So we're talking tonight about ethical issues in publishing a newspaper. But I think that begs a question, and the question is, you know, why publish a newspaper at all? What is the point of publishing a newspaper? So I think we need to identify a few important points. Number one is literacy. Reading is important. Being able to absorb issues in a sophisticated way, in a lengthy way, and not just in sound bites and little flashes across the screen and little phrases here and there, but being able to read news in depth is important. It's important for literacy. It's important for the capacity to carry on a civil discussion in society. So I think one of the reasons why people publish newspapers, certainly in my case, is to promote literacy, that is to say, to be an educational tool. Second of all, newspapers publish to inform people. It's important to have information. It's important because if you're going to decide who to vote for an election, you want to know, you know, what the positions of the people are. You want to know what's happening in Israel. You want to know what's happening in Denver. And again, there's many sources to get this kind of information. But in my opinion, the best place to get it is in a newspaper because you'll get it most in depth there. That is to say, it's more than a paragraph. It's more than a headline. And then there's the specific reason why you would publish a Jewish newspaper. You'd publish a Jewish newspaper because you're dedicated to the community. You want to see the community grow. And you want to see pieces, people, places, institutions in the community that may not have that much to do with each other, that may not otherwise communicate that much with each other. You want to put them in touch with each other. You want to promote a sense of we're all part of one community. Now, when you publish, ethical issues arise all the time because a lot of information that people need to have is sensitive information. I'll give you a classic example. In the year 2000, if I recall correctly, Gary Rosenblatt of the Jewish Week in New York published a huge expose on a person named Baruch Lerner who was, I can say, guilty. He wasn't guilty necessarily at the time the article was published, but he was later found guilty in a court of law and served time in prison for sexual abuse. It's a very unpleasant topic. It's a topic we prefer not to talk about. It's a topic we wish we didn't have to read about. But I think he did a great thing, because what he did was he sent a message to any potential abuser: you cannot hide. That's a very important message. And as a matter of fact, since that article published by Gary Rosenblatt, any number of people have been exposed. And what that means, any number of potential victims have been prevented. So there's, you know, ethical issues are always a double-edged sword. It's very nice not to publish the things we prefer not to see, but there could be direct benefit that come from publishing these things. At the same time, I think, at least, maybe not all journalists would agree with me, I think that it's possible to publish sensitive information, but you still retain a cleanliness of language, not to get involved with obscene language, which unfortunately pops up more and more in newspapers that I read, not to mention in other media. And I think it's possible to have a sense of restraint in what one publishes without sacrificing the need to get the information out there. So again, we come back to this idea of the ethical issues of double-edged sword. We need to get information out there. Sometimes it's sensitive. We want to get out there because it's helpful, not simply to, you know, to be sensationalistic. On the other hand, I think we can do it in a restrained manner and in a sensitive manner. And so we're always walking that line. And, you know, hopefully we walk the line carefully. I don't think there's a journalist alive who can't say that he fell off the line at one point or another, you know, in his career. And that's why there's such things as letters to the editor. But I do want to say this. Only that which is published in a newspaper is subject to suit. A newspaper can be sued for libel. An online information medium cannot be sued for libel. Therefore, the pressure to get it right, the pressure to be accurate, the pressure to be sensitive applies uniquely to a newspaper. So, Rabbi, I'll leave it up to you if that's a substantial enough introduction. And maybe we can go forth. And I don't know if it's possible in the format we're in, but I'm also open to questions should people have them at some time during the presentation.
Yes, absolutely. And if there are any, as I mentioned before, if there are any questions at this point for Rabbi Goldberg, so you are welcome to unmute yourself and to raise those questions now. And then as we proceed, we'll stop every so often if there are any questions or comments. And I'm sure that Rabbi Goldberg also will have what to speak about as I go through my sources as well. So if there are any questions or comments.
Rabbi, I missed the first 4 minutes, but for Rabbi Hillel, this Gary Rosenblatt who exposed this man, and you said, I think the year 2000, was he sued or was he in trouble legally with anyone for his article?
No, he wasn't sued. Not that I know of.
Uh-huh. Good. Okay. Just curious if...
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Many years ago, I had a situation in the community that I felt like I was not treated well by an institution. And as time went on, I thought about having it published in our local paper. And to make a long story short, I was turned down. The issue was turned down. And I always wondered what went into that decision.
I can't know without having my mind refreshed as to what the issue was and who the people were.
Well, you're speaking to Patty Zetlin, and it had to do with one of the local synagogues.
not enough detail for it to trigger my memory. But I will say okay. that I can answer this, you know, in a way that perhaps addresses your question. Number one, okay. is we have to be concerned about potential libel. We can't just
sure. say,
well, there's another thing I should say that's not widely known. Everything that's published in a newspaper, including letters to the editor that are signed by somebody else, those things a newspaper is responsible for under the libel laws. Newspapers have gone out of business because of letters to the editor that they published, even though the opinions they're in and the information they're in were not their own. So that's always a question. The other side of the question is how much resources, you know, a local newspaper has to investigate. In other words, when a claim is brought by anybody about anything, usually, not always, but usually there's another side of the question. So sure. depending on the complexity of the claim, is the complexity of the potential research process. As things that may be entirely legitimate to publish if properly researched might be beyond our scope because we don't have the, you know, the manpower to do that.
Okay. That makes sense.
Okay. Rabbi Goldberg, we have a question on the chat over here. Why should the internet be different from the printed word? And the second question, how would you distinguish, or how do you distinguish rumor from fact?
Well, rumors and fact. Let me start with that. That's a good question. How do you determine the difference between rumors and fact? So, first of all, it depends on the source of your information. For example, when we get something from a respectable news service, we assume it's true. It may or may not be true, and we may do our own investigation if there are questions. And sometimes there are questions, and sometimes we can do the investigation, and if not, we simply don't print it. But there is also another method to determine the difference between rumor and fact, that you really don't need to be a journalist, you don't need to be a person in my position to know. I think everybody in his life or her life is the recipient of information, and you know that it's highly unlikely that it's true. There's a bias behind it. There's an agenda behind it. You know, we can determine that the same as other people. And then the third question is, what's the importance? You can have, you can have a rumor and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, but is it significant? Is it important? Is it something that really merits pursuing? Now, the first thing you asked me, can you repeat?
Why should the internet be different from the printed word? Now, before you answer that, we just got another comment on the chat. And by the way, for those of you who are wondering why my head keeps swiveling, because I'm looking at two screens, my sources and the Zoom screen. So I apologize for that. But Section 230, this is the comment. Section 230 of the U.S. Communications Decency Act limits liability of internet platforms for something published by someone else. So maybe that from Dan Garfield answers the question, why should the internet be different? But Rabbi Goldberg, if you have anything to weigh in on that, please.
Well, I'm not sure that section applies to newspapers, but assuming for the sake of argument that it does.
No, it looks like it limits liability for the internet platform.
There are a lot of standards that we try to uphold with respect to letters of the editor. I must say that in most cases, it's not necessary to resort to these standards. Most of the material received is perfectly fine. It may agree with what we publish, may not agree. That's fine. And there may be no issues involved. But, you know, we have received letters to the editor that might not be subject to any kind of prosecution under the libel laws. But they, they're ad hominem. We receive letters that criticize rabbis.
You froze up.
And we're still good, I think.
And they make no point. there's a rabbi says something, it's legitimate discussion. A rabbi does something, it's legitimate discussion. But we received letters over the years that just, you know, take off on a person. They don't like a person. We're not going to publish libel prosecution. But that's part of maintaining a newspaper that can reach out to the community without simply diving into the dirt.
Okay. Okay, so thank you for that, and thank you those who weighed in. So I will get started over here from my end. Just give me a moment, I'm going to share my screen so that everyone can see those sources. Okay, and you should be able to see those sources now on your screens. And okay, so here we go. Just give me one more moment, please.
I have it up on the screen, yes.
Yeah, you have it. I'm just trying to put everything into place over here on my end. That's all. Okay, there we go. All right. So as I told Rabbi Goldberg when I was preparing this, I'm going to start off with a somewhat provocative source over here, and he felt that perhaps it's not that provocative. So I guess I will be a little disappointed if it's not as provocative as I had hoped it would be. But source number one is a quote from a fairly lengthy letter from the great Chofetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, who passed away, I believe, in 1933. He was the preeminent righteous, or what you call tzaddik, one of the greatest Torah scholars of his era, and probably the greatest leader of the Jewish people during that era. And he spoke out often about what he saw as societal ills and problems among the Jewish people during his time, which was, especially between the two world wars, was a very tumultuous period. And he wrote the following, and this is just a small excerpt. He says, "Behold, the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara, has found a new device to cause our Jewish brothers to sin through reading newspapers, which have proliferated in our time, in which can be found words of leitzanus." I'll translate these terms. Leitzanus means mockery, lashon hara, that's of course slander, rechilus, which is gossip mongering, or, you know, giving over negative reports of what one person said about someone else, and so on. Machlokis, which is fighting, disputes, and words of heresy. So, as Rabbi Goldberg told me when I shared this source with him, so he said, okay, you know, we can basically close up shop if we stop right here. Everyone canceled their subscriptions to all newspapers, Jewish, non-Jew, whatever it is, just close everything up. But, however, it's important to note that the Chofetz Chaim was talking about the newspapers that were popular in his day, which were publications that came from largely from Jewish movements that were very aggressively opposed to traditional Judaism, and made no secret of it, and actually aggressively spoke out or mocked, as he writes over here, traditional observant Judaism. And so he had a big problem with these newspapers, because although they were ostensibly to give the news, they also went out of their way to try and damage traditional Judaism. Again, and really, if you know a little bit of the history of what went on in Europe, both before World War I and between the two world wars, there was a lot of aggression from different movements within Judaism, communism to say the least, but other isms as well, against traditional observant Judaism. And so a lot of what the Chofetz Chaim is writing over here is coming out against what was common in those publications. Now, because of this, because of these newspapers, there arose what we'll call kosher newspapers. Publications in Europe between the two world wars began being published and distributed throughout the Jewish world, which were meant to give a what we'll call kosher alternative to these less than ideal publications, and to be able to give a different perspective and a different view, and to be able to give people who wanted a newspaper to read, who wanted to be able to catch up on the news and so on, an option which would not have these problematic items in it. Okay? Now, the reason also I want this source is because the Chofetz Chaim does point out a number of issues that come up in many newspapers. Okay, a newspaper that is not being published according to what we'll call traditional Jewish law often will have some or all of these issues. It will feature mockery of important things. It will feature Lashon Hara, no shortage of that in the mainstream media today, of slandering people. It will have plenty of rechilas, what he said, what she said, and gossip and so on. It will have no shortage of engendering machlokis, of promoting fighting and disputes and sharp disagreements, not just objective, honest conversation, but promoting fighting and so on, and words of heresy. And there are many publications which, even after the World Wars, even today, contain some or all of these things. He doesn't mention over there, but I think it's safe to say that in the world today, following the counterculture movements of the 1960s, certainly, and until this day, there's no shortage of lewd material, inappropriate material, sexual material that is present, even in what we'll call the cleanest of newspapers, be it in pictures, be it in the stories that are presented, and so on. So there's no question that a regular run-of-the-mill newspaper does have certain issues that are antithetical with traditional Jewish observance. And so therefore, today as well, in today's day and age, this has been in existence for decades, there are many Jewish publications that really run the full gamut of the Jewish world, certainly, be it more observant, less observant. You have many, many Jewish publications within the traditional observant Jewish world, what you might want to call the Orthodox Jewish world. You also have many different kinds of publications across with the full gamut, whom they cater to, what their content is, and we're going to try to discuss some of that as we go along. But a lot of these publications were founded either in order to advance a particular agenda, or because there were people, usually Torah leaders within the community, who saw the need to offer a kosher alternative without the issues the Chafetz Chaim mentions, and to be able to offer a publication that does not have the slander and the inappropriate material and the heresy and the promotion of machlokis and so on, which tends to be present in standard mainstream secular world newspapers. Okay, so that is kind of an introduction to our conversation. Okay, so let's talk about some of the issues which come up, and then we'll try to have a more general discussion about how we'll call Torah observant publications, how their decision making process of what to include and what not to include works. Again, I'm not going to be able to give you a specific blow by blow account. That's nigh well impossible. But just to try to understand from a Torah standpoint what some of the parameters, some of the guidelines that these publications are following, what are they basing on what they choose to include or not to include in their publications? All right. I'll just dive right in and say right off the bat, as I'm sure many of you present know, there are some Orthodox publications that will not publish pictures of women. There are some that won't even, publish pictures of a woman's wig because, you know, some feel that is already provocative. Others are very offended by that and they feel, what's the big deal to put a picture of that in there? And so on and so forth. So it certainly elicits a lot of controversy. There's no question about it. But let's try to see some of the sources and try to see where these guidelines are coming from, whether each individual agrees with them or not on a micro level of each decision that's made, but at least to understand where these things are coming from and what is guiding the decisions of these publications. So source number two is a verse in the Torah, actually in this week's Parsha. The Torah reading of this Shabbos will feature this particular verse. And this is in the final Parsha of the Shema. We say, and you shall not go after your heart and after your eyes, which you stray after them. As always, it's a little bit awkward in the English. I'm just giving a pretty literal translation of the Hebrew. Okay, and the Torah says, you shall not go after your heart and after your eyes, which you stray after. What does this mean? So the Talmud in Brachos 12b says, ideas of heretics, thoughts of sin, and thoughts of idolatry. From where do we know these? Whatever the context of that passage of Talmud is, what is the crux of the source is. As was taught in a Braisa, after your hearts, this refers to heresy, and after your eyes, these are thoughts of sin, The term sin, whenever it's found in the Talmud, refers to sexual immorality. Okay? And that you stray, these are thoughts of idolatry. So here is a passage in the Talmud which forbids thinking about these things. And this is one source, there are a number of them, but this is a major source for a prohibition, not just of engaging in heretical conversations or following heretical ideas. It's not just a prohibition about engaging in immoral kind of behavior or in idolatry, but rather it is forbidden even to think about these things. Now, this probably needs a whole conversation unto itself about controlling one's thoughts and so on and so forth. Jimmy Carter famously got in trouble while he was running for president about...
I think we should mention that this verse is in this week's Torah portion.
Yeah, I mentioned that. I believe I mentioned that, yeah.
I didn't get
correct.
It.
But... Yes, that is true. All right. So Jimmy Carter famously got in trouble for admitting to, having lusted in his heart. And the reality is that it's not always easy to control one's thoughts, but there is an obligation to do one's best to not go, not to stray, not to dwell on thoughts that are inappropriate. Now, if one is reading a publication, okay, in a broader context, be it a book, be it a magazine, be it a newspaper, be it an internet article or a YouTube video, whatever it is, anything, which contains inappropriate material, be it idolatrous, heretical, or sinful in the sense of sexual immorality, improper content, so that is a transgression of this mitzvah, and it's a serious issue. And consequently, there is a problem to be reading any of these kinds of things that contain this kind of content. Okay, so from a Jewish mitzvah, from a Jewish obligation standpoint, for a publication to include content which is basically causing a person to dwell on these kinds of ideas would be rather problematic. Okay, so that's right off the bat, a major area which you will not really find, or not find at all, in a publication that is following Torah law. You will not be finding these kinds of things because you're basically, if the publication is following traditional Orthodox Jewish law, so then to present these ideas to their readership is to bring the readers to transgress this mitzvah, and that would be problematic. Okay? Now, again, how far do you take this idea of avoiding thoughts of sin, thoughts of idolatry, thoughts of heresy? How far does one take that? So this is where life gets very gray, because as within many areas of Judaism and of observant Judaism, how far one must go to avoid sinful thoughts, how far does one go is the subject of a lot of debate and controversy. So there are basic laws in place, basic set in stone guidelines, but there's a lot of gray area as to how far things go. So just as an example, if you go into some synagogues where there's a mechitza, there's a partition between the men's section and the women's section, which is required by traditional Orthodox Jewish law. But how high is the mechitza going to be? Is it possible to peek through? Can you see anyone through it, and so on and so forth? So depending on how we'll call stringent the members or of that particular shul, of that particular synagogue are, you will get different levels of stringency. There's a basic bare bones requirement to have a partition of a particular height. But beyond that, it depends on how careful that particular shul, that particular synagogue, how careful the membership wants to be. And you will find all sorts of different kinds of partitions and machitzas within different synagogues across the world because of this. And the same idea can be shared in the context of a publication. Some publications don't have a problem publishing pictures of women, assuming that they are not provocative. Okay, to put in a provocative picture of a man or a woman is inappropriate regardless. But if it's not a provocative picture, so then the question becomes, okay, how do you define not provocative? Where do you draw that line? Should there be a picture in there of women at all? Because men tend to be looking at these pictures, and is even a very modestly dressed woman, is that provocative or not? Okay, and I'm not issuing my personal opinion on this, but because it's not relevant, I'm not publishing the paper. But I think that very often a lot of publications which will avoid, let's just say, publishing pictures of women altogether are probably following the desires and the need and the wants of their readership or of a significant portion of their readership who feel that this is a necessary stringency that they want to have in their publication. You like it, you don't like it, that's the reality. And it's not based on nothing. It is based on a reality that there is this mitzvah to be careful about what you look at. Again, how far does that go? Different people have different levels of how careful they are. Okay, but at the end of the day, you will have some publications will include this kind of stuff. Others won't. What kind of stories do you include? How do you draw the line on what is called provocative and what is not? Some publications will not have anything associated with anything romantic or anything of that sort for the same reason, even if it's fairly innocuous. But why expose our readers to that? It's not appropriate for them. Others, again, where you draw that line. So what you choose to include in the realm of male-female type of stuff, and by extension, what is defined as heretical? For some people, heresy is saying you should get vaccinated. Maybe that's a little bit extreme. For some people, saying climate change is real is heretical. For some people, putting in a thought from a certain rabbi whom they don't like might be heretical. Again, where you draw that line of what's called heresy and what is not depends on the publication. And more often than not, it's not necessarily based on a strict halacha per se, but rather on what the preferences of the readership are. And because the customer is always right, and because you want to cater to the customer, to your readership, so therefore you're going to try to adhere to what is a relatively reasonable need of your readership. And hence you'll get some publications that have a broader sense and some with a narrower sense. Okay, if there are any questions or comments at this point, I'm happy to take them. If you do have a question, you do have to unmute yourself, just a reminder of that. No, nothing but stone silence. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. Just takes a minute to get unmuted, or okay. Few seconds.
Go ahead.
What about the possibility of just sort of sticking to the facts? Because whenever you sort of get, you know, somebody's opinion, you know, nothing is objective. So what about instead of who thinks what is provocative and where the line is, what about just, and this may be pointed toward Rabbi Goldberg, is just the facts, ma'am, kind of thing.
Well, there's no such thing as just the facts when it comes to visuals. When it comes to pictures, there's no fact.
You can publish
up to the forehead. You can publish up to the nose. You can publish up to the chin, and you can publish the whole body. So it is certainly a subjective judgment when you determine how much of a picture you're going to publish. Our policy is we don't publish provocative pictures of women. On the other hand, we don't ban pictures of women.
Who makes the decision about what's provocative?
Well, what's provocative is what's revealing. And I don't think that's too complex. When it comes to, words, just publish the facts. We try to do that. That's a goal. That's an ideal. I can't tell you we always mean it or anybody always means it. But I do think there's a radical distinction today between newspapers that try to be objective and those who don't. I am shocked to see what New York Times has devolved to. There's very little I can read in there that doesn't have an opinion from the first paragraph on through. I can't tell you that we're always objective. We try to be. Some no longer try to be. And we're only, and that's print media. Certainly in other media, there's very little attempted objectivity. I think that's a defeat for newspapers. I want to draw attention to something that, the good rabbi said about Lashon Hara. There is perhaps not often noticed, the Chofetz Chaim talked about newspapers. There is a distinction between a daily newspaper and a weekly newspaper. Now, the basic facts or the basic halacha is the laws about lashon hara are, you know, if it's already out there, if it's known by three people, somebody else says it is not lashon hara. So almost everything that we publish is known out there. So therefore, we don't really fall under the category of needing to worry about publishing lashon hara, except rarely. Sometimes we will have the first piece of information on a story. It's a scoop. That's what a journalist always wants to have. But I can tell you, if that scoop contains lashon hara and we will be the first to publish it, we don't publish it. That's against our journalistic interest. But we will not publish something as lashon hara if we are the very first to put the information out there. I want to point out something that is kind of an inherent contradiction in the so-called kosher newspaper. I need to preface this comment by saying that I subscribe to three of them. I read them. I like them. I benefit from them. I salute them. They make a tremendous contribution. But when you publish a newspaper that has as its premise, if you read us, you don't need to read anything else. If you read us, you don't need to go to any other medium, which may well have Rechilas and Lashon Hara and Leitzonos and Machlokas, et cetera, et cetera. So when you have a publication based on that premise, but on the other hand, there are certain things you won't publish, then you cause the reader to go to those other publications that you don't want him to go to, and which are, and the existence of your own publishing is based on them not going to it. And again, I'll come back to this question of, I'll give two examples. One is sexual abuse. It's important to know who's out there as a criminal. And if you're not going to publish that information, then you're causing the reader to go to these other publications that have all these problematic aspects. This is an inherent problem in a so-called kosher newspaper. The other issue involved there is I think something that's stated in the name of halacha, which is not halacha. I'll give another example. At-risk children, children who are using drugs, Orthodox children who are using drugs. There was a period of time, a long period of time, that was not allowed to be talked about. That was not printed. And then there became a time when it is printed. Now, did the halacha change? I don't think the halacha changed. Halacha doesn't change. But what that means to me is there was a certain sensitivity or judgment that said, oh, we're too embarrassed by this to publish it. And then that sensitivity changed. And I think there's a danger, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with having varying sensibilities and acknowledging that certain problems that may not have been talked about in the past need to be talked about now. No problem. My problem with that is casting it under the banner of halacha. In other words, oh, halachically, we cannot print stories about children who are at risk, who may get involved with drugs. And then all of a sudden we can. It's a judgment call, and that's it may be a wise judgment call, but it should be called that rather than cast as something that's within the framework of the definition of a kosher publication.
Okay. That's Rabbi Goldberg's points are well taken from this end. I think the answer, I don't know that I can give a full-throated defense. I'm not a magazine or newspaper publisher. My assumption would be, my understanding is, and I've actually seen editorials in some of these publications that have spoken to these, some of these ideas, is that, and maybe we should wait till we get to more of the sources. Let me just touch on it briefly, is that not every, we'll say, scandalous kind of situation going on within the community is necessarily appropriate to bring into the public because, number one, not everyone knows about it per se, and therefore it can be a little shocking for people, especially a younger readership. And when you have a readership that is very often, on a younger age scale, you have a magazine, let's just say like a Mishpacha magazine, which is a very popular Jewish, Orthodox Jewish publication, which comes out weekly, and everyone in the house from age six till age 60 or older are reading it, you don't necessarily want your six-year-old reading about these kinds of things. Once it becomes, anyways, that everyone knows about it, everyone's talking about it, and it's par for the course, and that's just part of society, so then the concern of exposing the younger person to that kind of information is not as big a deal. Another issue is that sometimes when you have very hot-button issues that are extremely sensitive to the community, so then people aren't necessarily ready to discuss it publicly until the leadership and the powers that be within those communities that are reading these publications have processed it, have developed an approach to it, and so on. The point that you make about, well, how can you say you don't have to look anywhere else? I can't speak for them. My guess would be that it's not necessarily halacha per se, but it's a more hashkafe, Jewish outlook, philosophical outlook on what are we comfortable putting in here and what will our readership be comfortable having in there. It's very exciting to read a scandalous article, and people, you know, some people might be very excited to read it, but a lot of people will be scandalized by the fact that you publish it. People are not going to be happy with that. And so very often, even if it's not halakhically prohibited, but in more of a spirit of the law of what is appropriate to expose our readership to, some things are not necessarily appropriate to be discussed in a public forum, sometimes until they're more fully processed, sometimes not at all. And they have to be discussed through more back channels just because that is the nature of the subject. So sexual abuse is a good example where it's generally not discussed publicly even now in a lot of these publications, but it's not a subject that people are comfortable with, and not just from a comfort standpoint, but from a Jewish outlook standpoint, where these issues are generally kept to private discussions. They're not discussed publicly as they are in society at large. And therefore, people, you know, it's not appropriate to start making it comfortable for people. They don't want to be desensitized. It's not appropriate for them to be desensitized to discuss sexual issues publicly and so on. So my guess is that is why very often, can you say it's a strict halacha? Will you find it in the Shulchan Aruch or in the Talmud? Not necessarily. But the decision makers in a lot of these publications have a board of rabbinic leadership who are guiding them. And what's appropriate, and they say, you know, it's not appropriate to put that kind of thing into a publication at this point. But as Rabbi Goldberg pointed out, the flip side of that is that you're right. There will be people who will say, well, I want to know about it, so I am going to go to other places for the news. And you're right. That is the price to pay. You can't have your cake and eat it all the time. And I'm sure that these publications are constantly weighing and balancing the need to be able to present as much of the relevant news as possible while simultaneously balancing the need to be sensitive to what their readership expects and what the spirit of Jewish law expects as well.
Well, you're right. There are a lot of good reasons not to publish things. And one of the things that no reader of a publication ever knows is what the editor decided not to publish. Now, I can tell you that before we go to print, there's a lot of things that are decided that we don't publish. And of course, you want to maintain a good spirit and not just be technically within the realm of the law. But I think that brings us back to where I started. Ethical issues are double-edged swords. Yes, there are benefits, obviously, to retaining the readership, and there are benefits to retaining a certain standard. But sometimes there's a loss. Sometimes there's a defeat by not publishing certain things. And I think it's important to recognize that whatever position you take on any given piece that you publish or don't, you probably are not going to cover every base. There may be stuff that's the decision is a good decision not to publish, but there could be a defeat. That is to say, another side of the story, a loss for not publishing that. Doesn't mean you necessarily should have published it. But I think it's important to recognize these issues don't often lend themselves to, an absolute black and white decision. But there is something else which is very regrettable, very regrettable. There is what I would call gratuitous Lashon Hara, gratuitous promiscuity, gratuitous leitzanus. That is to say, sometimes stuff comes in and, you know, things happen and, you know, should you publish, should not, it's a legitimate debate. And sometimes there's things that, maybe could be subject to debate. But there is so much more that's being published these days. It's just gratuitously unnecessary. Maybe that's what the Chofetz Chaim, when he was talking about the kind of publication which just seemed to thrive on the machlokas and the stirring controversy and animosity and, you know, improper language, improper visuals. I must say that's what bothers me as an editor more than anything. The stuff that's hard to determine, you could come down on one side or the other. There could be good reasons to publish or not to publish. Okay. But so much stuff crosses my desk that it's just beyond the pale. There's no conceivable benefit to publishing it. And what's disturbing to me about that is that so much of this is being written, so much of it's being consumed, so that the media, whatever you want to call it, the media atmosphere, the media world today, the standards, generally speaking, have become lowered, you know, very greatly. There's language, I'm not going to repeat it, obviously, but there's language that's used now in daily newspapers that wasn't used 20 years ago. There's language that's used now every day that wasn't used before the Anita Hill hearings. So when we talk about, you know, ethical standards in newspapers, there's different gradations of the discussion. The level on which Rabbi Fleischer has this and the level on which I hope I operate is one level. There's a totally different level out there. That's very distressing.
Yeah. Okay. I want to move on now to another issue which potentially could come up in terms of what's appropriate to include, and that is when we talk about a scoop or things like that. When can you publish, let's just say, private information or information that you were given by a source or that you obtained from a source, assuming there's nothing illegal about it? Source number three, Rav Manasseh the Great said, that was his name, from where do we know that if someone tells his friend something, that he, the listener, is subject to the prohibition of do not say it until he is told you can say it? It is derived from the verse, and I did not get involved over here in the technical side of how exactly this is inferred, but what I want to pull out of this source is an idea, and that is that not everything that you are aware of is meant to be shared. It's attributed to Rabbi Salanter and Rabbi Goldberg. You'll probably know better than I if he actually said it, as you did the publisher work on him. But I believe he said, not everything that is thought is meant to be said. Not everything that is said is meant to be written. Not everything that is written is meant to be published. Whoever said it, it certainly has a lot of merit, that idea. But here we have an idea that if I tell you something, okay, which sounds like it's a private matter. I'm not, you know, telling you who won the ball game yesterday, you know, or what I ate for dinner, which you might be able to find that by checking Facebook anyways. But rather, I'm telling you something which has an element of privacy to it. Even if I didn't tell you, don't share it. But you know there's a possibility that I don't want that being public knowledge. You don't have a right to share that information until you get permission from me. Okay, and this is very relevant when we talk about including information in a publication, where even if you obtained information from an individual, but that person did not give you permission to publish it, and there's potential that he wants it to remain private, it may not be published. Which brings us straight to source number four: a person is obligated to conceal a secret revealed to him by his fellow in a secretive manner. Meaning, if I tell you information in confidence, okay, you cannot reveal it, even if revealing it would not involve refilos, which is I'll call it for brevity's sake, a subdivision or a type of lashon hara, of slander, because revealing the secret causes damage to the owner. Okay, and secondly, one who reveals a secret deviates from the path of modesty and violates the wish of the secret's owner. So there's a lot to unpack here in this source. Number one, when you reveal a secret, you can cause damage to the bearer of the secret. Number two, it's immodest. Okay, people often talk about modesty in the context of clothing, but really modesty is a much, much broader idea of modesty in general behavior. not everything, as I said, not everything that's thought has to be said. Not everything that's said has to be written. Not everything that's written has to be published. You know, keep quiet. Not everything has to be shared. You don't have to talk about everything. And so that's a deviation. To share private information is a deviation from what we call tznius, modesty. And third, you're violating the wish of the secret's owner. So again, for a publication that has a scoop, that has inside information, whether or not they should publish that information from a Torah outlook, it very much depends on where the information comes from. The bearer of that information, is he okay with it being shared? Will people be harmed in the process? And so on and so forth. Okay. And so it's a serious issue which has to be considered in a world of trying to scoop and get scoops and inside information, and a source has revealed, a leak has said, and so on and so forth, where publications are always busy with leaks and so on and so forth. Certainly in our previous president. But from what I understand, during the Watergate scandal, the reason why some of the lower level people involved in the Watergate scandal were called plumbers is because Nixon called them in to investigate the leaks in the White House. And that is why, that's why they were referred to as the plumbers. But the idea of publishing leaks is not a simple matter according to Torah law, because that's private information. Who gave you the right to share that information? That's private information. And sharing secret information is problematic. Okay?
So most of the time, when you have a piece of sensitive information that is obviously that obviously doesn't concern anything else except the person's sensitivities, and the person doesn't want it published, we won't publish it. Probably most publications won't publish it. Here's where it gets sticky. A person says, oh, I don't want this published. This is private information. And what's being protected, however, by the person saying this is not the person's sensitivity. What's being protected is vital information without whose publication people may be harmed. Let me give you kind of this will illustrate the case. What if we had a Bernie Madoff here? And Bernie says to us, you don't publish this. This is sensitive information. I don't want this published. Well, we know that the reason why Bernie Madoff doesn't want it published is he's a first-class crook. And he's a criminal, and if we publish the information, you know, it's all going to get exposed. So the mere statement that something is really sensitive and shouldn't be published is not necessarily a justification not to go forward and publish it. It depends why it's requested to be kept private. It's a private matter, no problem. It's something that I think would be titillating to the readers, but it's not something that the source wants published. Fine, no problem. We won't publish that kind of thing. Where it gets tricky is where the person's hiding something that should come out. Let me give you another variation on this scenario. It's a problem that all journalists have. Somebody tells you something and says, I don't want this published. Now that's somebody. Is a very good source. That somebody is somebody you go to often. That somebody is somebody who tells you stuff and wants you to and lets you publish things all the time. Then the ethical question for the journalist is, well, to what extent do I accede to a request on the part of this source not to publish something when it really should be? Not because I have some kind of sensitivity to the person, but because I want to retain him as a source. This is a tricky question that journalists go through all the time. When do they withhold information that shouldn't be withheld, not for legitimate reasons, but simply to retain the source? This is something that I don't think there's a perfect answer to. Again, ethical issues are double-edged swords.
Yeah.
But clearly, when the issue is strictly personal and you happen to have found out something and other people will be titillated that the person doesn't want it, I don't think it should be published.
Okay. Yeah, I'm in agreement with you for sure that there are situations that require, and in fact, halacha would require, and I'm hoping to get to that idea shortly, where the public, it's not just like people are curious, or as you said, you know, scintillating,
I mean,
or scandalous.
Various institutions, worthy institutions, lost tens of millions of dollars because of Bernie Madoff.
Right.
And somehow or another, it didn't come out. They would have lost a few 10 million more.
Yes, that is true. There's no question. In fact, there's a mitzvah in the Torah, which I did not include in my sources, of you shall not stand by your brother's blood, which I've invoked in many other classes, where there's an obligation. There's an obligation
Let's reduce the circle. Let's say we have Bernie Madoff in the room, and Bernie Madoff's wife, and Bernie Madoff's kids. Okay? And we'll throw in Bernie Madoff's rabbi. I don't know if he had one or not. We'll throw him in. Okay? And we're having a discussion, and I got the goods on Bernie Madoff. And they're all telling me, oh, this is going to ruin, you know, our life, and it's going to be difficult for the, you know, for the wife, and, you know, it may cause a divorce, and who knows what will happen to the children. And we know what happened to the children very sadly. And so all this, you know, heavy emotional guilt trip is put on the journalist, and you could say, oh, well, we shouldn't publish this. Look what might happen. But then on the other hand, I think we all know that what was published about Bernie Madoff was necessary to be published. So it's tricky.
It is. And part of that trickiness is also that in a case which you referred to as the case of Bernie Madoff, but let's say you have a case where not sharing the information would have a more limited damaging effect, or on a much more limited group of people, a halachic authority may say you cannot publish it publicly, but you do have an obligation to inform anyone, you know, the smaller group of people who can be harmed of this information. And so every, you know, on a case-by-case basis, it really needs to be ascertained. When do you, if you have, let's just say, a predator who is a danger to society at large, and it's confirmed that he's a predator, so that may well be grounds to publicize the information in a public way. If we're dealing with a situation not of that nature, where the potential for people being harmed is much more limited to a small circle of people, it may very well not be justified to publish that publicly, but rather to just let those relevant people know. Which really, as we are starting to run out of time, if you look at source number 7, there's a list from the Chafetz Chaim, a list of conditions where a person is permitted to share, we'll call Lashon Hara. And this would probably extend to private information as well, a similar kind of framework, where information that normally should not be shared, but in a case where it's what we call toelas, there's a need, there's a benefit to save people from harm and so on, so then the information may be shared, and in fact, very often must be shared to save people from harm, but there are rules and regulations about how that information can be shared, when can it be shared, and so on. You know, you could see the list over here in source number 7 for yourself, and again, this is a very basic rendering of those conditions, and I don't have time to go through all them in detail, but it's always, you know, this is why a lot of these publications have a rabbinic board to guide them into what is appropriate, what fits within the halachic pale of being appropriate to publish when these kinds of things come up, and what is not.
You know, there is another aspect of this, which notwithstanding the tremendous competition in media, notwithstanding the capacity of electronic media to get stuff out immediately all the time, there is another option, which does, notwithstanding all that, does come into play. Frequently, the solution is you simply sit on the information. I have the information. I could publish it. I could not publish it. But on the other hand, I could do it. There's a third option. I can wait. And if you're in control of the information sufficiently, and it still happens, you can wait. You can see what might develop. You can see what more you might learn. You could see going forward, whether this is truly important public information or it's just simply stuff that's personal and would be gratuitous to publish. And that happens. And that's often a good solution, because frequently when you wait, it's like everything else in life, get a little more insight as you go along. So, you know, we have stuff from time to time. We'll just hold it. We'll see. Okay, we'll see what happens. we'll see what might additional information might come our way so that we can make a better judgment in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. This happens too.
Yeah. All right. We are just about out of time. We are out of time. I do have one question here again on the chat. I think this is a question for Rabbi Goldberg. Do editors as a profession have any obligation to regulate what is done by the industry, quote unquote?
Well, I want to thank you for your tremendous intelligence to bring to this, as I'm sure you do to all the other ones, and for your Torah teaching. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in. And, hopefully we've all gained and learned from each other.
All right. Did you want to, Rabbi Goldberg, do you want to address that last question?
Number eight?
What? No, we got a question on the chat. I'll share it again. I guess you didn't.
I haven't seen it.
Okay, so I'll read it to you right now. Do editors as a profession have any obligation to regulate what is done by the quote-unquote industry?
To regulate what? I didn't hear you.
To regulate what is done by the industry, quote-unquote.
Which industry?
That's the word industry is in quotes.
For some reason, I can hear the people asking the questions much better than I can hear you.
Okay, if it's not coming through and we're out of time, maybe I'll just put it aside.
All right. So that means we'll have to do it again. We'll have to have a round two.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Rabbi Goldberg. Thank you all for attending. We will be on break, at least that's the plan, for July and August. And God willing, we are hoping to be back together in person. Hashem should continue to move things forward in a good direction with us. Hope to see everyone in person come September. Have a good night. Have a wonderful Shabbos, everyone.